Session number 17585, Reel 1.
I was born in Chicago, December 1914.
Were your parents American?
Well, my mother was. My father's family had been in planters in Jamaica since early in the last century.
And your mother came from Chicago?
Yeah.
How long did you stay in Chicago for?
Till I was 6 weeks old.
And then?
I went to Jamaica, where my father lived, and where we had a big estate.
Did you grow up in Jamaica?
No, we left Jamaica. I went to school in America from 1923 until 1932.
Whereabouts in America?
In Massachusetts.
What kind of a school was this?
It was Belmont Hill School. It's a private school.
And then did you come to England?
Yes, a lot of my family had been soldiers in the British Army, going back nearly more than 100 years. And I'd always wanted to be a soldier, which was not easy to do living in America, because the examinations that I'd have to take to get into Sandhurst were not exactly what I was doing at school in America. But I got a nomination from the Governor General of Canada, where we were living at the time. So I was able to go to Sandhurst, even though I was a little too old.
Which years were you at Sandhurst?
1934 to 35, 2 years.
What did you think of the course there then?
Oh, it was very different, I can tell you, from being at school in America, where you were shouted at all day, changed into different kinds of uniforms 5 or 6 times, and studied military things, which in America, of course, you never saw any soldiers and never knew anything about military life at all. But I'd always had a hankering to be a soldier, so I was delighted to have this new discipline.
And once you finished at Sandhurst?
I was gazetted into the 8th King's Royal Irish Hussars, who were in Egypt. But first I spent about 8 months with the Scots Greys in Edinburgh, as one always did. My regiment was in Cairo, and when your regiment's abroad, you always spent the first 6 or 8 months of your service in England with a different regiment.
Where were you when Chamberlain declared war on Germany?
No, that's quite a long story, because from the 8th Hussars, I was going to go on secondment to the West African Frontier Force in northern Nigeria. And I was on my way there, in fact, sitting on a boat going down the Nile to Wadi Halfa. I was sitting on the deck when war was declared. We heard on the radio. Well, we'd been expecting it, of course, because it was quite obvious from August on that it was going to be declared. So it wasn't a surprise. But I was, of course, very disappointed, thinking that I was miles from where the war was going to take place, which is not a good thing for a soldier. Little did I think what happened to me later. But at that time, I thought, I'm going to miss the war. It'll be over by Christmas or so, they tell me on the radio. And so I won't have been in the war at all.
Did you feel any sense of excitement or dismay or any other feelings about the war declaration?
Well, one had been watching the situation, as everyone had been, for the previous 2 or 3 years, really. And one had expected it to come. But of course, one had, as a young officer, 20 years old, one had absolutely no idea of the awfulness of it, and rather looked at it as if it, when my regiment took part in the Battle of Balaclava, this was my idea of war, or the Battle of Dettingen. this was not at all what was going to happen.
I think your first actual active service was in the East African campaign.
That's right. I went to the 2nd Battalion of the Nigeria Regiment in Kano, and we were, when the Italy came into the war, we were destined for East Africa because of the Italian threat from Abyssinia and Eritrea. So as soon as war was declared by the Italians and they came in, we went, we were put on ships and taken to Mombasa, and where we were, they were massing, we were massing troops against a huge force of about 500,000 that the Duke of Aosta commanded in Abyssinia. And we were to be part of the Nigeria Regiment with the Gold Coast Regiment, and the King's African Rifles were all lined up to either defend Kenya and Somaliland or to attack Abyssinia ourselves. We didn't know which was going to be. And in the event, when I got to, when we got to Nairobi, the military secretary came to me and he said, "I see from your dossier that you were in an armored car regiment." And I said, "I had been." And he said, "Well, wouldn't it be a good thing for you to get back into that rather than to be with infantry?" And I said, "Yes, but how is that possible? Do you have any armored vehicles out here?" He said, "Yes, we're just raising a regiment, the East African Armored Car Regiment, which will be made up entirely of Kenya settlers. You see, most of the European population of Kenya and Tanganyika, Uganda, went into the King's African Rifles as officers, and none of them as warrant officers or as other ranks. But the Kenya settlers had pushed to have their own regiment where everyone from trooper to squadron leader would be a Kenya settler. And this was the regiment of armored cars that was being raised. And the ranks of squadron leader, second in command to squadrons, commanding officers and second in commands were all going to be regular officers. The Kenya settlers themselves would only go up to the rank of second lieutenant, commanding a troop. So I was given the rank of major and given a squadron of armored cars in the East African Regiment. And we were for 6 months in the Northern Frontier District watching the borders of Abyssinia and Eritrea. In Somaliland. And then in February 1941, two divisions from Kenya, the 11th Division under Cunningham and the 12th Division under Godwin Austin, moved into Somaliland and Abyssinia. My regiment led the advance for nearly 2,000 miles. It had to take place on roads that were very, very limited. But nevertheless, we went through Somaliland, where the 11th Division went to Mogadishu, and then north to Addis Ababa, whereas the 12th Division, to which my squadron was assigned, went from Somaliland across the Juba River back into southern Abyssinia as far as Ngeli, which is on the borders of Kenya and Abyssinia, and then we went, my squadron, went up the Rift Valley from Ngeli to Addis Ababa, and all the way we were the first in contact with the retreating Italian forces. They only put up sporadic and rather half-hearted resistance. We had to do some fighting, but usually after we'd engaged for a very short time, the Italians would either lay down their arms or retire and move back out of contact with us. So we had a very interesting time leading the way for nearly 2,000 miles. And we saw a great deal of what the Italians had done in colonizing the country, which was extremely impressive. They'd only been there for, since 1936, so about 4 years. But the amount of work they'd done to accommodate the Calabrians and the Sicilians and so forth who were their colonists was simply extraordinary. They had done the most marvelous work in very, very unfriendly surroundings to make their colonists very, very comfortable with nice houses, roads. These, of course, were only here and there. This was not a solid infrastructure, but we would come across certain places like Sodu in the center of Abyssinia, or Diridawa on the borders of Somaliland, which were settlements of a certain size, say 4,000 or 5,000 people. And in those settlements, the work that had been done by the Italians was quite extraordinary. They were tremendous improvisers. And if they didn't have what they wanted, they made what they wanted out of something else. In fact, after the war, when I left the army, I recruited one of these Italian companies that I'd noticed their work in Abyssinia and Somaliland, and harnessed them to British finance, and we created quite a successful company which still exists, called Sterling Astaldi, which really came from my having observed what remarkable people they were working in difficult circumstances. Anyway, we led the advance, and Addis Ababa was taken, which virtually ended the campaign, although a very big pocket at Karen remained for another, held out for another 4 months, I think. And then...
How much did you have to do with the Somali and Abyssinian populations?
Well, we didn't have anything to do with them. The Italians had had their own colonial administration, and when we took over, we left it as it was, wherever it was. There wasn't a great deal of... it was very, very thin on the ground. It wasn't as if one had to organize a tremendous population. They were very small populations wherever they existed, and they didn't really need a lot of organizing because they were so small, you know. 500 people, 1,000 people, that sort of thing. And the only places that were of any size at all were Addis Ababa and Diridawa, and in Somaliland, Mogadishu and Ishabaidoa. Otherwise, there was really nothing. So, we eventually arrived in Addis Ababa, and then I spent another 6 months with my squadron at Diridawa on the borders of Somaliland, actually in the Danakil country, which is where there were very, very dangerous tribe, the Danakil. And we had to be careful because they were quite capable of stealing up on our squadron at night and cutting a few throats. So we watched it fairly carefully. And while we were there, I was warned that I was to go back to my regiment, who were in Egypt. The 8th Hussars were then in Egypt. They'd taken place in, taken part in the big advance that O'Connor had made, right up to Mekelle in April, I think, 1941.
Just if I can go back to the Danakil.
Yeah.
Did you actually have casualties from that?
No, we had. I didn't have any casualties because I was very careful to see that we didn't. You've seen them probably on television. It's below sea level, and they mainly they are salt deposits there, which are very valuable. Because you can sell it to the natives all over the country. And this is what they professed to do, but actually, and they were very, very jealous of anyone coming into their country. And so I had to be quite careful. I treated them as enemies, but we didn't have any trouble. And so from Diridawa, I went back to Mogadishu, where I took a boat to Mombasa, and eventually was routed from Lake Victoria up the Nile and back to my regiment, who were on the borders of Libya with the 7th Armored Division. When I got there, the whole of the force under Wavell, or I think he just left, I think it was Auchinleck, were just about to be launched on the, what was called the Crusader operation, which was supposed to relieve Tobruk. Tobruk had been in German hands. I'm not quite sure how long. I think from probably April, and we're now talking about November 1941. And all our forces were lined up on the Libyan border, ready to make a sweeping attack onto the south, around Tobruk and relieving Tobruk. This, of course, has been very well described in dozens of times by various people.
What was your own role in the regiment?
My own role, having come back from being a squadron leader and a major, I reverted to captain, and I was put in charge of what we call the thin skins. The thin skins was a very small collection of vehicles organized to carry petrol oil and to keep very close to the battle. It wasn't the B echelon, was another, was the big force that stayed 10 or 15 miles back out of the battle and were ready to supply. But we were had to stay right on the very edge of the battle, so that if necessary, in the middle of fighting, they needed replenishment, we were right at hand. It was quite dangerous because we moved without any armor at all, within gun range of the enemy. And we had to be there when tanks could run out of fuel or they could need something, and we had to be there. Anyway, the battle waged fiercely. It's well recorded. I don't have to go into that. But
can you say what you saw of it yourself?
Well, what I saw myself was that our tanks, called Honeys, I forget what their proper name was, they were American tanks that had been supplied to us, and we were very pleased with them. They were very fast, they could go very fast, but they had very thin armor. And in fact, when we got into battle, which we did twice a day for the first 5 days before I was captured, usually every morning and every evening, there was a big battle. The Mark IV of the German could hit the Honey tanks at 1,600 yards and put them out of action. And we had to go within 600 yards before the Honey gun would make any impression on the German Mark IV. So we were really hopelessly outgunned, and our armor was so thin that we lost all three squadron leaders in the first battle and many, many people over the next 3 or 4 days. It was a very unhappy affair. My regiment, in fact, suffered tremendous casualties, as did the 7th Hussars and several tank regiments. We'd been really, today, with the careful study that's given everything, for instance, before the Gulf War, we were led to believe that we had in our Honey tanks were very fast, and we were told, this is your protection. You can move fast, much faster than a Mark IV, and this will be your protection. But it didn't work out like that at all. They were able to take us on in a way which left us almost no chance unless we went right up close, and that's where we took a tremendous number of casualties. Nearly wiped out the regiment, nearly wiped out the 7th Hussars as well. And altogether, it was our first real lesson at what the Germans were like in a tank battle. It was the first tank battle of the war at a place called Sidi Rezegh, the air landing ground just south of Tobruk. And it was a proper tank battle, went on for days. Of course, in the desert, you could fight and then go away, and you could come back and fight, and you chose your time. The Germans usually dictated when it was, and this went on. It was our first real taste of tank warfare, because in France there was never any confrontation between tanks. We were retreating all the time, for one thing, so all we hoped to do was to get out. But this was proper and very, very severe punishment we took from the Germans in this first battle. I was captured at that time, and so that was 22nd November 1941.
Can you describe the circumstances under which your capture took place?
Yeah. With the thin skins, I had gone up to Sidi Rezegh landing ground with the commanding officer and were watching the battle, where we were not involved at that time, and he was making an assessment of what he was going to do with the regiment. And the Germans put down a smoke screen and moved up anti-tank guns behind the smoke stream, and so were able to fire on the regiment over open sights. So we started a retreat in the smoke, and we ran back as fast as we could out of range of these guns, which we couldn't stop. And I went back in my little wireless truck with the commanding officer. And after we'd gone about 5 or 6 miles, we pulled up out of range of the anti-tank guns and formed a leaguer. with the object of bringing in brigade headquarters, which we left behind on the landing ground. We formed a Liga, and the men got out of their tanks ready to show the brigade headquarter tanks into their proper position. And we were all there getting this organized when we heard the tanks, the noise of the tanks approaching, and we thought this was the brigade. And shortly afterwards, we heard German being shouted from all the tanks. It was, in fact, a detachment of Rommel's force. And so fighting took place hand to hand on the ground. Nobody was in tanks. We weren't anyway, they were. And it was a very nasty affair. I had my wireless truck unarmed, and I had no troops that I was responsible for. So I made a bolt for it to go and find my thinskins and get reorganized. After a while, I heard tanks around me. It was dark by this time. And I thought I would, I couldn't tell whether they were friend or foe because, as I say, it was dark. And I thought, well, in case it's Germans, I'd better get out of my wireless truck and be on foot so that I could lie down or keep out of the way somehow, which I wouldn't have been able to do in my truck. And in a while I heard tanks around me, and I lay down in some scrub. And shortly after, a spotlight shone on me, and they fired a burst of machine gun over my head, and there were about three tanks within 50 yards of me. So I put up my hands, and that was that. It was, in fact, Rommel's headquarters that had captured me. Rommel was sitting on a tank smoking a cigar when I was bundled along. So from there, for the next 3.5 years, I was a prisoner.
Did Rommel speak to you?
Yes, he did. He said, I speak German, and I asked him, I said, I'm alone, I can't do any harm, why not let me go? He said, no, not at all. He said, we've made a big hole in your armored forces, and we're going to, tomorrow and the next day and the next day, we're going to finish them off. He said, but anyway, good luck. And he drove off. But we had been told that we had done, you see, when we fired a gun at 600 yards, you'd see it hit the tank. And if you had a direct hit, we took it as being knocking that other tank out. Actually, it didn't at all. It bounced off. In other words, when we made our calculations of what we had done, it was inaccurate. Because unless we happened to have hit a weak spot in the Mark IV, of which there were a few but not many, our guns fired shots that bounced off the Mark IV, but it looked to us as if we'd hit them. So we made a miscalculation of how much damage we'd done to Rommel. And he had many more tanks. This was 5 days after we'd started the advance. He had many more tanks than we estimated that he had. And next morning, when dawn came, and I was in the middle of his forces, I think the 15th and 21st Panzer Divisions, he was virtually untouched. Whereas we were really put out of action in a very, very big way. My regiment, I think, out of, I don't know how many tanks, we probably had a fifth of them, that's all. And I think the 7th Hussars would have had the same, and the 3rd Tanks would have had the same. The tank regiments had better equipment than we did because they weren't supposed to be light reconnaissance vehicles. But This was a lesson we really had to learn, and we didn't get proper tax for another 2 years after that.
So how were you treated at first by the Germans?
Well, it had been evidently agreed that the Germans would take, that the Italians would take care of the prisoners. See, the Italians had about, at that time, even as early as that in the war, we probably had a quarter of a million Italian prisoners. And they were very conscious of this, and they had no prisoners of ours, because it had all been the other way around. So they had asked the Germans to let them have all prisoners taken by either themselves or the Germans. So I was not held by the Germans for those days, and still in Cyrenaica, but by the Italians, who treated us quite well, but they weren't prepared for prisoners, so...